Welcome to Best Movies Never Made, the podcast where we explore interesting and infamous movies that never made it to or through production. I am your co-host, Josh Miller, and with me, as always, is Mr. Steven Scarlatta.
How you doing today, Josh?
I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
Fantastic.
And we are very excited. We're always excited to do this show, but it becomes extra exciting when we have on a guest who's someone that we very much revere and have always wanted to talk to. And that person today is the legendary filmmaker and Oscar-winning visual effects artist, Mr. Phil Tippett. I have to assume if you listen to a podcast like ours, you know who Phil is. But on the off chance you do not, I guarantee you, you have seen his work in the original Star Wars movies, Dragon Slayer, RoboCop, Jurassic Park, Starship Troopers, the Twilight movies, and I'm leaving so many out. Most recently, he directed, produced, wrote, did the animation for a very, very amazing movie called Mad God that if you have not seen, you should frankly stop listening to this podcast right now. Go watch the movie. Come back. Just do yourself a favor. But thank you for joining us, Phil.
My pleasure.
And we're lucky enough to get you because you are out promoting a also very excellent new documentary, the RoboDoc, the creation of RoboCop, which is a four-part docuseries on Screambox. By the time this episode airs, all four episodes will be up and available on Screambox. So I guess we can just talk a little bit about that. I'll say on Steve and I's ends, we've watched several of the episodes and I absolutely love it. It's, you know, a lot of times with these documentaries, you only get a handful of the people involved, you know, which is fun, but you always kind of wonder what the other people had to say. And this doc just has seemingly everyone who worked on it, down to the mime that Peter Weller hired to help him train.
Yeah, well, Yoni Akeem made that movie. You know, really, without him, it would have been in the toilet.
But I mean, you know, again, people should watch the doc if they want to know more about RoboCop.
Yeah, it's so detailed. Like, it goes through every scene and talks to practically every supporting actor in every scene. It's incredible.
I only worked on three scenes, so I was around, you know, for most of it, and it was very illuminating. I you know, learned a ton of stuff that I had no idea about.
And again, I guess for those who don't know, but again, I feel like if you've seen RoboCop, you know, Phil worked on Ed 209, which is, I mean, I was way too young when I saw that movie. My mom read a good review of it in the newspaper, which somehow convinced her that, you know, this is a sophisticated movie to take my child to. And that scene where Ed 209 takes out the executive in the boardroom, which now as an adult, I find hilarious. But as a kid, I found that deeply disturbing.
Well, your mom didn't just rip you out of there right then and there.
She was trying to be a cool mom. She did regret it very much.
how old were you?
I mean, that was 87, right?
Yeah.
So I was like 10, 9 or 10.
Yeah, well, my kids were really, they grew up watching horror movies. So, you know, that didn't bother me.
Yeah, and my mom knew I did too, so maybe.
My wife and I were in watching it in a theater, and a woman, you know, brought her, you know, like 6-year-old to see it. And my wife went up and said, "What the fuck are you doing?" You know, she said, "Shut up."
Well, it was such a great summer too. So many wild movies, Living Daylights and Spaceballs and Predator. I remember I went to see it. I thought it was just going to be a silly movie, and then
sounded like it.
Oh my god, dude! It blew my as Josh said, that the when the executive gets shot up. I was a kid too. I stood up in my seat like, whoa! And yeah, I was classic, immediate classic.
I mean, I actually have a question for you, not about RoboCop or the documentary itself, but you've been involved in so many legendary projects. Like, where do you just generally land on the kind of legacy of these and, you know, all these decades later still doing interviews and documentaries? Is that something you enjoy? Have you kind of gone through phases where you're sick of talking about these movies?
No, I'm like, you know, happy to give of myself. I answer all my fan mail, and you know, I'm happy to talk about people to people about this stuff, you know, in a lot of ways, or many ways, or in every way. It's kind of like, hey, Grandpa, can you tell us the one about Goldilocks and the three bears again?
Yeah. Except in your case, they're like, tell us about the AT-ATs and Empire Strikes Back. But I guess, yeah, transitioning into things, you know, and again, I think this has all been kind of documented elsewhere, but more so for our younger listeners who are less familiar. Just get what, you know, what's your origin story? How did you get into the business leading up to all the movies that became so legendary?
Well, when I was six, it was Shoten Sack and Cooper's King Kong. I saw on tiny little black and white TV, 58, Seven Voyages of Sinbad, which just opened everything up for me. And yeah, then it just took off from there. Those are the two huge inspirations. I mean, King Kong fired me up to be fascinated with dinosaurs, so I studied them, you know, all up until the time. Well, I continue to keep my fingers on the pulse of paleontology, but you know, I was well up in all the you know, latest paleontological, you know, theories and finds, you know, until Jurassic Park. And then Jurassic Park cured me of dinosaurs. Like RoboCop cured me of, you know, robots and Star Wars space aliens.
And what was the process? I mean, yeah, I still think it's not necessarily the most obvious path for a younger person who wants to go into animation, is knowing as far as like what schools to go to. But back then, what was kind of the path you had to take to get into the industry? Where does one even start out when you're like, I want to, you know, I want to be a Harryhausen?
You know, as a kid, you don't even think about it. You know, you just feed yourself. Then one thing leads to the next. You know, back then, there weren't that many people that were interested in this stuff. And so you find each other one way or another. And we all just happened to be congregated in Southern California. And, you know, I mean, there were like, I would say like a half a dozen people, really. And so it was, you know, very easy to, you know, find the few mentors. In my case, David Allen and Jim Danforth at Cascade Pictures of California, a commercial house, a really pretty big commercial house in Hollywood, where I met Dennis Muren and John Berg and Tom Santamon and Ken Walston, and all these guys went on to, you know, work on Star Wars and whatnot with.
So cool. Speaking of Jim Danforth, he was going to make a project called Time Gate in 1976, and mm-hmm. you put up the trailer, which I fucking love. It's like one of these well-known unmade movies. Can you talk a little bit about that by any chance? I'm so fascinated with this movie.
Yeah, so, I mean, that was all very exciting. Jim got a warehouse in Burbank. A bunch of us, you know, that I just mentioned, got together and, you know, helped them out doing stuff. I designed a ton of dinosaurs for it, and, you know, was sculpting and went out on location to, you know, shoot the first few scenes and things that he could get together for a trailer. And, you know, Jim just kind of shot himself in the foot. You know, he was such a perfectionist. Only he could really do things right. And in many ways, you know, he was correct. You know, I mean, he was way ahead of the curve. I mean, he was the guy at that time that could actually do all of the above. But, you know, when the director starts drilling holes in metal, you know, you start to think, is that really where your attention should be going? You know?
To explain to the audience, it was Dimension Pictures back in the 70s. It was supposed to give him $500,000. He was going to make this movie about futuristic game hunters who go back in time to hunt dinosaurs. And so it was such a badass concept.
John Broderick was the producer. John was a really nice guy.
How far did that even really get into the project before it sort of fell apart?
It got as far as Jim firing me.
Oh no.
Well, you know, Dewey Swafford, the production designer, Jim had a temper that was very well known, and he really gave Dewey a reaming, and I let him know. I thought that that was, totally uncool, and then he said, "Well, you can work from home from now on." And then 2 weeks later, I wasn't working anymore, which is fine.
Oh, that's too bad. Yeah, I guess you got to work on some dinosaurs in that one.
Yeah, and then I was a gig worker like I always have been, and so I would just wait for the phone to ring because there were nobody else really doing this stuff, so
All
yeah.
right. And what year was that, Steve? It's around 1976. I think, was that before? Oh, I guess, was that after Star Wars? Or, I mean, the date I have is 1976. It could be wrong. Was that before or after Star Wars? I mean, I know Star Wars is 75, right?
It
Oh,
was
77
right
Star
in
Wars.
that neighborhood. It could have been before or after.
Yeah.
I did some stuff for Dave Allen for the Crater Lake Monster, built the Crater Lake Monster and did some shots in that. And so that's all like a jumble. All this stuff happened like basically within the same year.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was wrong. Yeah, 76 is Time Gate, 77 is Star Wars. I got confused with Jaws 75. I always get those 2 years confused. And then do you by any chance remember again, like, I guess he called you back again, and like right after Clash of the Titans, he was going to make a movie called Force of the Trojans. And I guess that was supposed to be like a Clash of the Titans type movie with the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse and a talking Sphinx. Sounded pretty crazy.
We thought it was all kind of crazy to call it the Force of the Trojans, which kind of like, okay, that sounds like something an old man would like not, run across his radar. But Charles Schneer, yeah, Ray was, not going to make any pictures anymore. And so I was courted. Well, since who else was there, number one? And also Schneer wanted to kind of infiltrate Lucasfilm for whatever value that had for him. And wanted to be me to be Rey, which is what I had aspired to, really all my life. I mean, that was like a dream come true. And so I had to make a decision on this day or by this day. And I bought like a pint of Jack Daniels and drank it and visualized the Libra scales, and just weighed the thoughts. And staying at ILM with all of the technology and with the crew, and Ray worked by alone, for so many years. And when I was on Dragon Slayer, I would go out and have lunch with him while he was working on Clash of the Titans. And he would be looking at his beer and saying, "Oh, Philip, I feel like a monk." And so I just worked alone, all that time. And when I was in college, in art school, I was relatively well connected to the LA art scene, and that was going to be my next step. But of course, I my love was doing all this other stuff, and it was the same thing, weighing the scales. It was like, I don't want to be an artist that works in scared. I want to work with other people. I really, had already worked in some commercials and whatnot. And so I wanted to work with the team, and go out to lunch with people, and that was the clash or the whatever Force of the Trojans thing. It was like the scales just kind of went bink, and so Jack Daniels helped me make my decision. But it was, up until that, I got drunk, it was a hard decision for me to make. It was like, yeah, that is from 7 years old. I just wanted to be Ray Harryhausen.
Yeah, so cool. You got to, be friends with him and all that, I mean, I guess you were one of the very few doing stop motion and being like part. Were you guys all part of a clique, the stop motion guys, like with Ray Harryhausen?
We were not a clique with Ray,
No.
Ray, well, we were in, Hollywood, and he was in England, and Ray was, of course, very secretive about what he did, which, by a certain point, we all knew or how he did things. But I think to his credit, Ray had the really liked the or respected the the role of the magician, you know. And so you don't give away your secrets, you know. You just want the audience to have a magical experience, unlike today, you know, where you can, you know, all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed if you want to find out how something's done. So yeah. So anyway,
I'm trying to remember because I was too young to necessarily know any of this things when Clash of the Titans came out. Was that kind of announced as Harryhausen's last movie, or did it just become his last movie?
I don't know. You know, again, Ray never, he was like what you call a belt and suspenders man. You know, I mean, he, you know, would never, you know, really let you know what was going on or played his cards close. That's what that's a better analogy. And so he had some bad experiences on Clash of the Titans, and that Schneer wanted him to shoot some scenes in a way that, I mean, I think it was like one of them was a scorpion scene that, you know, Ray lost his light, and then that made all the background plates look like shit. And so I think that was one of the contributing factors to him like getting out. And then, you know, he was also seeing technology change, you know, and the the whole interest in, you know, phantasmagorical images change. And, you know, Ray always liked the, you know, mythological stuff, and didn't really like or understand Star Wars or any of that stuff, but he could see the writing on the wall. And, you know, just like me, at a certain point, it's like, you know, you have enough, you know, of it all, you know.
Yeah,
going on location, being away from your family, and all that. So it's time to hang it up.
Yeah, I had a couple of, I mean, I'm sorry about, I want to ask you about Star Wars. You've been asked all day, but there's this mysterious creature in Return of the Jedi called the Light Man. Someone posted an image of him in Jabba's hut. He was very strange, but it was so cool looking. A man with just lights all over him. Do you remember? Did you design that? Or someone mentioned your name with it on Twitter, and I was just kind of curious about that.
No, there are a number of things like that. That spidery thing that walks across the background when Luke comes into Jabba's palace and stuff like that. Well, that particular one, you know, was in Mandalorian. Jon Favreau wanted that, that back to life. And then the Light Man. No, there were a bunch of other things that the practical guys, Kit West, came up with for George, and George wanted a Light Man, but, you know, like some things, it just didn't work, and it didn't work. You know, it just, it was a bad idea.
I love the image of it. Was it your idea, though, to put the brain on Bob Fortuna? I read that in a book.
The brain?
Yeah, that said Bib Fortuna, God, Bob Fortuna, Jesus. Star Wars fans fucking screaming at me right now. Said a creature designer, Phil Tippett, gave him a brain that kind of hangs around. I got this from a book.
Those are tentacles.
Tentacles.
Yeah. No, George wanted, he said, Bib Fortuna. And the direction he gave me was like something like the Elephant Man, which I thought, you know, that's not very elegant for a major film. And so I came up with that design. And that design was really, really clicked when they put like the red eyes and the vampire teeth in. I didn't have that in my little maquette, you know, but that was really, that made the guy like really fucking creepy. And when you were on the set with him, if he looked at you, it really gave you the chills. Next question.
Steve, as I say, you got
to go back one last Star Wars question. I swear to God, you worked on the cantina scene in the first Star Wars, and I did read that George Lucas already shot that scene, but he didn't like the creatures, and then so he brought you guys in to redesign and redo the cantina.
Well, scene. There were a couple of things, you know. I mean, George didn't actually have the money to, you know, make his vision, and so I think they really skimped, you know, when it came to the cantina scene that they shot in England. And it really looked like they raided the costume department you know, and pulled out a bunch of moth-eaten Beatrix Potter outfits. And then Stuart got phlebitis, and that compromised him. So George was able to talk Fox out of some money to, under the auspice of our buddy Rick Baker, hire a bunch of, you know, 4 out-of-work stop-motion animators and Rob Bottin to, you know, as George would say, and he did many times, you know, make as many space aliens as you can in 6 weeks. And then we went down to Insert Stage on La Brea Avenue and spent a couple of days. You know, we actually played a lot of the monsters that we had made. And Carol Ballard was the DP and shot for a couple of days. And it was during that period that George would come by once a week and check our progress. Previously, you know, he had intended on using those chess set, costumes that we had made, you know, to be the holograms, but Michael Crichton had just come out with Future World, which had a similar idea with live action characters on a knights on a chess set. And George was not happy about that. And then he saw, I happened to have brought in a stop motion puppet that I made when I was much younger. And so that gave him the idea to do the chess set as stop motion. And again, like, you know, I would hear over and over again, make me as many space aliens, you know, as you can in, you know, in 2 weeks. And, you know, so my partner John Berg and I made a bunch of really quick things. Oh, and he said, you know, this thing that I had made, he's like, can I have that in my movie? I was like, yeah, sure.
To fast forward, after you did RoboCop 2, you were going to work on a movie called Dinosaur, and you were going to, believe, was it going to be you and Paul Verhoeven directing it?
Mm-hmm. We got a great Waylon Greene, you know, who had written the remake of The Sorcerer, and Waylon did, you know, I think Jump started, if I remember correctly, NYPD, but Waylon was also like a naturalist, so it was really perfect. And the way that came about, we were shooting at 209 in the stairwell, and you know, Peter was coming down the stairwell, you know, and he did a first take, and I said, Paul, he looks like a duck coming down the stairs. And like, Paul got mad at me. I mean, it was like 110 in that stairwell. And there were all sorts of problems with them wanting to shut us down and whatnot. And so he's like snapping at me, and it's like, you know, and then the costume guys, well, you know, said, well, we used his stunt shoes, and his normal shoes have a, you know, foot hinge in it. So they sent him back to get that done. We were just sitting in the sauna, and, you know, everybody was the whole crew, you know, down there in that tiny stairwell. And everyone was complaining about how nobody can make any good movies anymore. And I said, I have an idea to make a movie about dinosaurs. And like, Paul lit up, and they're like, dinosaurs that could be cosmic. You have geysers of blood shooting into the sky. And so that really excited him. And that got the ball rolling with John Davison, hired Waylon. He wrote a really terrific script. And there's storyboards. And I did some sculptures of dinosaurs. And this was the first time in my life at Disney that I was banned from Dopey Drive. I have, Disney and I have crossed paths in the most undelightful way, you know, a number of times. And until they realized that my personality did not fit their expectations. You know? So they did what Disney does, is they will, you know, take an idea and mine it, and then slowly, you know, well, the dinosaurs should talk and they should have eyelashes and things, like wear pajamas or whatnot, you know. So you know, we bailed on that, which made them, you know.
Yeah, because this eventually became that movie Dinosaur that came out in 2000, right?
Yeah, Crock is shit. Really terrible.
That's such a weird evolution.
Yeah, there was a lot of the script that was there, but boy, was it. Well, and that was like, that was they bit off more they could chew than they could chew, because that was, computer graphics at a point where,
Yeah.
not a good idea.
It's like, yeah, what a movie. It would have been no dialogue, just these dinosaurs, and that's
That would
just.
be essentially a silent movie with, sound effects and score.
Yeah, because I was reading about the ending. There is this gigantic battle at the end as a comet is moving closer and closer to the Earth. And so it doesn't matter who, I mean, the good wins, but do they win because of the comet hitting the Earth? I think.
Well, that was, that's what enticed Paul the whole thing. I mean, that was what he's saying. It could be cosmic,
That would have been so cool.
Right, so haunting too, the ending there. Oh, so great.
Not to butter you up with flattery, but as I agree that that's a perfect example of a movie that felt like it had cutting edge visual effects that don't really hold up. And one of the things that's still so amazing about the first Jurassic Park, and I'd say Starship Troopers, is that the effects still look good all these decades later, even though they were so early in the evolution of computer animation. It's not a question. I'm just flattering.
No, it's funny that, but the reason for that is both of those movies, for the creatures, the teams that were doing it knew what they were doing. And so the producers hired all of the right people, and then what came after that was a cavalcade of, followers of people that just didn't have the skills. And then you just saw, everything for years just slump in the toilet, until, eventually there were enough schools that, eventually built an army of people. But the skill set was just not there. It was like a lake that was, 3 miles wide and a quarter of an inch deep,
I also read that Francis Ford Coppola had you design Pinocchio for him for his unmade Pinocchio, and I guess
Yeah,
because
we did a number of stop motion shots, for walk cycles and whatnot, build a Pinocchio.
what year was that, Steve?
It was like, I believe it almost started before Dracula, then he jumped into it more after Dracula around 93, and but Disney didn't want you to create Pinocchio that looks like their movie Pinocchio, but because it was public domain, you kind of had to design
That
it.
was never going to happen anyway. It was always going to be like Guillermo. It was always going to be Collodi.
What was the design like?
Was like Pinocchio.
Oh,
It was
okay.
very much based on the illustrations that were done for Collodi's books. Or that Collodi, yeah. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, because I always thought the project died because that Italian filmmaker made a Pinocchio, but I guess it was just because I guess Warner's he took it away from Warner's, took it to Sony, and then Warner's called Sony and was like, we have a contract with him, and they didn't. And then I guess there was like this crazy battle over it for years. And then
Yeah, I
he
thought it was Metro,
could be. Yeah, I could be wrong.
yeah, it was a big court suit, and that's the only time that what we shot showed up was in a court case.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was our audience.
Were they showing clips of it in court?
Just to show that Francis had put his own money into it, and was working on this other project, which was really meaningful for him, because it was like he lost his son in a boating accident. So a lot of the feeling for it came out of genuine loss for him.
That could have been a very cool project.
Yeah, especially with him and, coming off of Dracula, which was great. There was a project called Expedition that you were a part of. Do you remember that?
Yeah, that was funny. This happened in a period, my relationship with Disney would go up and down. And at this particular point, I forget who was, an actual filmmaker that was the head of Disney. And I had this idea for this big space drama or spectacle. And Disney gave us the money to hire a writer. And so we worked on that for a while. And the writer didn't understand what it needed to be. Or I at that time, it wasn't his fault. I just couldn't communicate. It was such a weird idea. I couldn't write. And eventually it crashed and burned.
Yeah, it sounded like a cool thing, like Expedition to Other Worlds. It's the only thing I could really find about it, but it sounded interesting.
Yeah, it could have been. But again, I think it was one of these things, like the dinosaur show, that was like, it wasn't ready to happen yet,
After Starship Troopers, they said that you guys were talking about doing a miniseries. And that was before you made the sequel, but was there, you guys were kicking around some ideas for a sequel, a TV series for Starship Troopers? Do you remember any concepts about it or anything? The only thing I could find was the Russian tribe version of
Starship. I think there were different ideas that were kicked around. One that excited Paul the most would be an attack, or I don't remember if it was before the movie was released and crashed and burned, or if it was for one of the episodes, but it would be like the Russian front. It would just be in this horrible, inclement, godforsaken, ice planet. And then there would be the whatever it was that they had mentioned in Starship, Zuma Beach, the tropical planet, things like that.
Yeah, it's like too bad Netflix, I guess, wasn't around back then to do something like that after the movie came out,
It would have been expensive. And, the movie opening weekend, John Davison called me up and said, well, we tanked, It's like, well, what do you think happened? He said, well, we made an R-rated movie for kids. But when Paul's asked, who he makes his movies for, he says, I make them for me, with no, of course, concern about the commercial success, but, damn the torpedoes and full speed ahead. He's an artist, and differentiated from a commercial artist, which is always what made him interesting to me, because we held very similar worldviews, would have philosophical conversations where we would agree that, we were both existentialist Buddhists.
Yeah, and I mean, for people who want to know more or more insight into Verhoeven, the robo-doc, it's so great that he participated in that. And the enthusiasm he still has all these years later is just kind of infectious.
Oh, you know what? So before Shudder picked it up, I sent Paul some DVDs of Mad God. He let me know that, he said, when I make my Jesus movie, I want you to do the scene where Jesus meets Satan.
Oh, that would be amazing. How is that something he's actively working on, or is that just kind of
pie
in the sky?
If he was allowed to make his Jesus movie, he would be assassinated. But he did write a really great book called Jesus of Nazareth that Paul is a Jesus scholar and would come up to Marin every year for the Jesus seminar and discern what the real guy Jesus was. Now, the book is just fascinating. And one of the aspects that is fascinating is you can tell there in the subtext that it's the voice of a filmmaker. I mean, not overtly, but that shines through. But it was also, John Favreau, once he'd seen Mad God, hired me to art direct, or, you know, come up with some concepts for the episodes where Mandalorian goes to hell. And so I did a bunch of work, you know, for that. So, I mean, it just, you know, kicked downstream, you know, that way.
Yeah, it's so cool.
How many years were you working on Mad God?
I shot 6 minutes right after Robo 2 and then shelved it because the scope was too big. And then I had no reason to believe it would ever happen again. But for some, you know, I just get on things like Ugly and an Ape, and I just couldn't let this thing go, you know, with no reason to believe that anything would ever happen. Did like tons of designs and tons of storyboards and studied Freud and Jung and art history and law. And then, you know, I was archiving the thing, you know, about, you know, 13 years ago. And the guys, some of the guys at my studio that wanted to be, you know, work with miniatures and, you know, lights and stop motion, saw it and thought it was this weird old Czechoslovakian thing. I told them what it was. They volunteered to do a shot that led to another shot. And then I get like volunteers from around the Bay Area, and things just like grew, you know, magically. And then, you know, we worked intensely on that for the next, you know, 12 years or so. And, you know, I'm friends with Alex Cox, who's in the movie. And to him, I was introduced to the composer Dan Wohl and sound designer Richard Beggs. And Richard Beggs is an Academy Award winner that goes back to the Stone Ages with, you know, like Apocalypse Now and whatnot. So, you know, it was, you know, I was really quite amazed to, you know, be able to gather this posse, you know.
Yeah, the score is so good. You know, it totally reminds me of that Czech guy that made those movies. I mean, but it's totally different, but I kind of got a little vibe from it. And that's why I really dug it. I thought it was a masterpiece. It's a beautiful, haunting movie, Mad God.
Yeah. And then I don't know where you can pick. I think it's on YouTube. Dan just did a... Oh, Carl Zeman, I think, is the guy you're thinking of.
He did Faust... and
no, I know the guy you're talking about.
John Sack. Oh God, I have dyslexia, so I destroy names.
I have dyslexia too, so
yeah, I got it on the tip of my tongue.
Jan Svankmajer.
Because when I was watching your film, I got some vibes of that, and you know, a movie called Begotten. But anyway, I loved it. I thought it was fucking gorgeous, and it's something I just even like having on in the background.
Yeah, I remember, I mean, probably like a decade ago, I don't remember why you were screening it, but I went to a screening where you were showing, you know, the however much of Mad God was finished at the time. And it was just basically it's so cool that it got that you completed it, because I feel like at the time it was the sort of situation where, at least for me sitting watching the movie, was unsure if it was going to be another, you know, 20 years of noodling on it in your free time. Remembering out loud, it's a long road to completion.
You do have a long history with John Davis, and did that like that start with Piranha and stuff? Because I could see that you were part of many of his projects, and Josh and I are massive Piranha fans. We always talk about your work in that movie, that little creature.
Yeah, well, I think John had just seen Star Wars and saw, you know, John Berg and my name on the credits, and we were in LA, and so he just came by, and you know, it just worked out from there. We became very good. He was a big stop motion fan, so was Joe, and they actually had to struggle to get those, you know, a 4 shots of the, you know, little fish creature in the show. And you know, as Joe said, you know, he didn't know if he'd ever be able to make another movie after that, but he wanted to make sure that he got some stop motion into that one. As John, you know, John and I became, you know, very good friends, and, you know, the rest is history.
Yeah. And no, he tried to get a Stephen King adaptation off, and then which one was that? And you were a part of it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I forget what the title was. It all kind of takes place, you know, aliens crash, come out of the fog. There's a ton of creatures. Everybody ends up in a,
Oh, The Mist? Was he trying to do that before Darabont ended up getting it made?
Yeah, and that's what happened is like Darabont got it and we didn't. But it was not that great. And it was at the end, I was glad we didn't do it because you could see with Darabont's why it would be really hard to pull off. You know, all of these things that are, you know, in one location just don't generally work out that well.
Were you designing creatures for it, or did it not
never got that far.
Okay.
Yeah. We also I wanted to do Mars Attacks, you know, based on the bubblegum cards.
Oh.
And so John took out an option against him. Whoever was, you know, had those. Alex Cox wrote scripts and studio didn't like him. And so John was able to get Martin Amis, you know, he's like a really famous writer, to do a few scripts, and the studio didn't like that. And then eventually Burton picked it up and got it.
Was that going to be more R-rated, if you can recall?
You know, if Alex was going to direct it, the studio wouldn't let him make it, you know, really.
Yeah.
I'm sure. Well, the main thing was, I mean, it was the studio's objection to it was Alex is a communist and it was anti-capitalist, you know, where the Martians come down and essentially do what, you know, we have done, the industrialized countries have done to the rest of the world, which is basically rape it. And in this case, you know, by selling useless trinkets, you know, to the Indians.
That would have been interesting. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Huge fans of his over here. Did you, I mean, speaking of Mars Attacks, were you ever offered Dinosaur Attacks? And I know multiple times that tried to get off the ground, and especially after there was a bunch of dinosaur movies announced after Jurassic Park, and I'm not going to bore you through them, but were you ever offered that or
no. The one it would have been cool to do, I have a collection of all this stuff, is Terrorist Attacks. Yeah,
I don't know that one. Cards.
I don't know that one either.
Is yeah, go look for it. It's horrible.
Sold. I'm sorry, I don't want to keep you too much.
Oh wow! I just Googled it. I'm looking at some of the.
All right, gotta check that out. Were you ever a part of this movie? I guess it might actually finally be coming out, called The Primevals.
Oh yeah.
Because I think they've been trying to make, I think since the 70s they started working on it.
Yeah, I worked on it a lot, you know, for Dave Allen, you know, and built a number of the creatures. And then with Charlie Band, he eventually made it. And then Dave got cancer and died. And what's the guy's name? Anyway, Chris Endicott took it upon himself and a few other people to keep working with the production footage that Dave had shot, and apparently it's finished. And I've seen the trailer, and it actually looks okay. There's some really terrific work in it, and it's available someplace, but I can't find out where it is. So, I mean,
I'm looking it up right now. It had its world premiere at Fantasia Film Festival this summer.
Oh.
Wikipedia at least doesn't have anything about its release. Yeah, wow.
Yeah, they started it in the 70s and they've been working on it since. It's so crazy.
Yeah, well, it was kind of, you know, Chris's eulogy to Dave, you know. He was going to, you know, finish it.
And that's awesome they finished it, you know. That makes me happy. I can't wait to see it.
We shall see.
I've been hearing about it for years, like through Starlog as a kid, and you know, see these images, and throughout my whole life, just, you know, so it's kind of cool.
Well, I think the you know, project was really plagued, you know, with money issues and whatnot. There's a whole story behind that, you know, would take, you know, 20 minutes to get through.
To the end. Oh yeah, one last one. John Davison also had a project called Bug Hunt. Do you remember that, or were you involved with that? Or
Yeah, that was going to be that just existed as an idea that I think he and Joe Dante came up with. That was basically a Pork Chop Hill kind of a thing. That would be like a low budget thing where everybody's confined. The soldiers are confined to a bunker on top of a hill and are being attacked by alien insects. And they tried to get that going. I had a couple of meetings with them. I think George was looking, I mean, John was looking for 40 million to do it. And he was shopping it around. And John was at Sony at the time and found out that Sony had an option out on Starship Troopers. And they told him, oh, if you can make a movie called Starship Troopers, then they would back it up. And so, that's how it all came together.
Oh, that's what killed it. Interesting. Sound like a cool concept. Well, we did get a good bug movie, so
Yeah.
cool, you know,
Hey, you
so.
know what was cool about it was I was at a dinner party here in Berkeley with Daniel Ellsberg was he was living nearby, and he said, "Phil, that movie was the best political movie I've seen in 10 years."
I mean, I
It
love that
is.
movie. So,
I do too. It's like a masterpiece.
I mean, something I'm excited about, but you know, also not overly optimistic. I'd seen that was either earlier this year or last year. I popped up in the headlines that Del Toro had reached out to you about an At the Mountains of Madness stop motion movie. Is there any likelihood that might actually happen?
No, I mean he developed it as a live action movie, but it would have been like a too expensive R-rated movie. But I've talked to him about it, and I have some ideas how it could actually be done for far, far less. So we're going to talk about that in the
Oh,
future.
well, I will pray for that one because that would
Yeah,
be
I'd love to
amazing.
do it. Yeah.
Yeah, we're gonna have to get that at some point. I mean, it's
It's Lovecraft is really hard to crack. Paul wanted to do some Lovecraft stuff. In fact, the brain bug in Troopers, he always referred to it as Cthulhu. That's how he saw the brain bug. But nobody's really, it's like Ray Bradbury. It's just, there's a lot of reasons why it doesn't translate to the screen. But if anybody could pull it off, Guillermo could.
I mean, I would have loved a Verhoeven Cthulhu movie as well. But thanks
Anything.
so much for talking to us, Phil.
Sure.
It was great.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And we will end things right there. Thank you so much to Phil Tippett for joining us. And thank you to you, the listeners, for listening. You can find Best Movies Never Made and Steve and I personally on all the socials. We also highly recommend that you check out our Patreon and consider supporting it, not just to, you know, support the show, but you also will get a lot of bonus free content, us talking about movies we love. We recently did a whole tribute to the career of Madman Albert Pyun. We'll be talking about box office. We have extended conversations with some of our guests, lots of fun stuff. So until next time, this is Josh Miller and
Steven Scarlatta.
saying we won't see you at the movies.